Crime Hive.
You're listening to Crime Hive, and this is another true crime story of how they were caught. Now, this story takes place March 2010 in southern Pennsylvania when someone called 911, but there was no response on the line. Dispatch would hang up and call the number back, but then would get a busy signal. They did some research. They found out that a woman named Monica Schmeier, 55 years old, lived at that home. And dispatch sent police to check it out in what's known as a welfare check, because they got to make sure that whoever called 911 is okay, make sure it's not an accident, make sure kids aren't playing on it, which is very common. But they send police. Police aren't getting any response at the door, and they enter the residence to make sure that everyone's okay. And sure enough, they found Monica lying on the floor in a pool of blood in her living room. She had obviously been shot in the head, and next to her on the floor was a .32 caliber casing from the brand Speer. There was no gun around, and her head was bloody and bruised. There was obvious trauma, and it was clear this was a murder investigation, not a suicide, not an accidental death, and they would start with the time of death. They surmised, based on the 911 call at 2:52 p.m., that was probably about the time she died. And so now they're looking for someone who doesn't have an alibi within that window. And so they're looking around the property. They find in her home all sorts of white envelopes with cash. Apparently, she didn't trust the banks, and she just kept cash in these envelopes all over. They started with people closest to her. Her ex-husband, John, had built an ophthalmology business and had to pay her alimony. So they quickly thought maybe he's involved in this, whether directly or maybe he hired someone, because he may not have wanted to pay this alimony. They found out he was part of a group of friends that called themselves the Orange Shorts Society. Kind of a weird name, but it was a group of men that would talk about politics and money and investments. And detectives would learn that there was a group meeting that day, and he was there in that group. So he did have an alibi. But this will come into play in just a little while, so keep this in mind. An autopsy was done, and it was determined that this was a close-range shot to the head. The casing was examined, along with a damaged bullet, and they looked at the rifling characteristics that shows what firearms possibly produced that bullet. And they surmised that the only brands that could have fired that weapon were either a Colt, Dixon, or a Celtic brand, and they needed to match that casing to a possible weapon. They didn't have a gun. They had the damaged bullet, which had markings on it that could possibly match up to a murder weapon. So they have some evidence to go off forensically. Now, police would canvass the area around the crime scene, and neighbors actually saw a suspicious man going in the direction of the victim's house before the 911 call was made. And this same witness saw the same person about 20 minutes later walking away from the victim's house. And this witness described the person as a white male, about 5'9", medium build, and had been carrying white envelopes in his hand. A second witness saw a similar description and actually saw this person drive away in a silver work van. Now, the witness didn't get a plate, but now police have a possible vehicle involved, and they start canvassing around businesses and residences with cameras so they can try to link up this distinctive big silver van in that area. And they actually find a van, this silver van that's going towards the crime scene before the 911 call and then moving away from that house after the 911 call. They don't see it right where the victim lived, but they see it from a bank camera just, you know, minutes away from the scene. But they surmise that this was most likely the van. Now, police tried to enhance the plate on the images that they gathered, but it was just too blurry. The bank camera typically looks for individuals. They hone in on individuals entering and leaving the bank, but not so much in the background where the van was. So it was very blurry. They couldn't enhance it. And that lead was sort of a dead end at that point. So police go back and start looking at the people they've interviewed. They look back at the Orange Shorts Society group, and they actually find out that there was one member that was not present at that group meeting the day of the murder, and his name was Tim Jacoby. They pull his driver's license, and the description matches witness statements. Furthermore, they find out he's got a past with the law. He had an armed robbery conviction, and he owned a .32 caliber Celtic pistol, which is similar to what police were looking for. They were looking for a .32 caliber type of weapon. Employment records for him showed that he actually drove a full-sized company van that was silver, and he knew where the victim lived. So police hone in quickly on Tim Jacoby based on this circumstantial evidence that they've gathered. They would search his property, but they don't find a gun. Instead, they find a .32 caliber Kel-Tec barrel, just the barrel. And it appeared that someone actually tampered with the inside of that barrel in a possible attempt to hide evidence. So they used some sort of tool to scratch the inside of the barrel. And this would disrupt any evidence police would try to gather after they test fired the barrel with a gun. They just couldn't get that definitive proof that the barrel fired that bullet that they were looking for from the crime scene. So this person was successful in evading police with that lack of evidence. But detectives were very savvy in this case, and they knew they were onto something with Tim. And so they start digging, and they find out that he actually used his parents' farm for target practice. And so forensic analysts would go to the property there, and they would actually find a gun box for the .32 caliber. They would find ammo for it and receipts for it, but they wouldn't find the gun. So in the area that he used for target practice, there were four spent shell casings. So forensics collected them. They were cleaned and examined, and it turns out they were manufactured by the brand Speer, the same brand as the shell casing found at the crime scene. It was a .32 caliber, and those tool marks are very unique to a particular weapon. And so those microscopic markings on the base of the shell casings were compared under a microscope, and the casings from where the target practice shooting took place on Tim's parents' property and the crime scene matched. Those bullets were fired from the same firearm. So this would tie Tim or someone on that property or using that property to that weapon. But all the evidence, all the circumstantial evidence would point to Tim. Police believe Tim knew about the money in the envelopes and wanted that money, wanted to collect that cash, found it to be an easy score. Now, police were still looking into the ex-husband, thinking maybe he was still possibly involved in this scheme. And they would dig through all his financial records, but they just couldn't find anything to connect him to Tim Jacoby. No payments made to him, and he was eventually ruled out. But they did arrest Tim Jacoby with that forensic evidence, with the casings and the van and the fact that he knew her. He wasn't at the meeting the time of the murder. He didn't have a solid alibi. Police would arrest Tim Jacoby, and he would be convicted of the murder of Monica. In October of 2014, he was convicted and sentenced to death and would remain on death row. And that was how he was caught. Crime Hive.